It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. Here we go. With Malia Jacobson as your host.
Hello, and welcome to Sleep Well, Stay Well. I'm your host, sleep and health journalist Malia Jacobson. I hope you're doing well and enjoying this unseasonably hot week that we're having in September, at least here in the Pacific Northwest. It is smoky, but it is also pretty nice outside, and I have been really enjoying these last few fleeting days of summer. I hope you are as well. Today, we are talking about a brand new pediatric sleep disorder called restless sleep disorder. Defining a new disorder is kind of a big deal, so we'll talk about what goes into that. And this is one that could potentially help a lot of kids and families. So I am really interested in telling more people about this and learning more about it myself. So if you live with a restless sleeper or you are one yourself, listen up. Today's guest is Lourdes Del Rosso, MD, Associate Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine with the University of Washington School of Medicine and Seattle Children's Hospital. Dr. Del Rosso is a sleep expert at the University of Washington, and she has worked with parents and families for years. She said that parents came to her describing children whose restless nights seem to involve more than the typical tossing and turning. In August, she and her colleagues announced that their work had led to a consensus on diagnostic criteria for a newly defined pediatric sleep disorder called restless sleep disorder. Children suffering from restless sleep disorder reported having trouble focusing during the day, emotional and behavioral problems at home and at school, irritability, and hyperactivity. Often these children have iron deficiencies, and supplemental iron was found to help with their sleep, and we will have her talk more about that as well. Dr. Del Rosso is here to tell us more. Good morning, Dr. Del Rosso. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Good morning. Good morning, Malia. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you here on this very smoky, hazy morning in September. We are transitioning into a new school year, and parents are trying to get their kids back on a school year schedule so that they can get up early for that first remote class of the day or participate in whatever kind of schooling they're doing. So I think the news that you have with a new pediatric sleep disorder is pretty timely. Can you talk about, first let's tell our listeners about restless sleep disorder in children, kind of what it is, what are its symptoms, how common is it, and what do you know as of now?
Yes, thank you so much. We have been studying restless sleep in children for the past 4 to 5 years, but I have always seen it as a sleep, pediatric sleep specialist, and so do my colleagues. When we started publishing about restless sleep, it was welcomed by all our pediatricians and pediatric sleep experts all over the country. So what it is a disorder in children that is characterized by frequent movements during sleep. So parents usually first notice that the child is restless, is moving, appears to be asleep, but is thrashing the bed, moving every time the parent goes in the room, the child is in a different position, the bed sheets are on the floor. Does it start probably sounding familiar to a lot of our audience? And then the biggest issue is that then the children are tired during the day and the parents notice that sleep is not really refreshing, that they do not really get the feeling of a good night's sleep. So during the day, it affects their daytime functions. And that's what started all our research on restless sleep that has produced finally a consensus diagnostic criteria paper, which is what was just in the news a couple of weeks ago.
So yeah, that's exciting. And we'll get into a little bit more about what restless sleep disorder looks like in kids. But first, I wanted to just kind of take a step back from that in terms of just defining a new sleep disorder or any kind of new disorder doesn't happen every day. Can you talk about what the process of, you know, what does that look like? How does a researcher go from thinking, okay, this might be a thing, to actually getting diagnostic criteria and coming to that consensus that you mentioned?
Yes. So For many years, parents would come to the sleep clinic saying, I know there's something wrong with my child. I know this child is different than my other children. I notice that they're really restless. There's got to be something. And with the diagnostic panel that we had before this diagnosis was accepted, we were not able to really identify or provide any thoughts as of what was going on with these children. We usually would do a sleep study. We would screen for other known sleep disorders. And because the child wouldn't fit in a category, we would be like, well, we don't really know. So what started to happen was all of those children, I started putting them together. Like I started saving their information and say, do you mind, to the parents, I'm gonna save this information. I'm gonna save the sleep studies. I'm gonna look a little bit deeper. And I contacted experts in movement disorders from all over. My mentor, particularly Dr. Raphael Leferri, is an expert in sleep disorders and movement disorders from Italy. And I contacted him and he was very interested in studying these children with movements during sleep. So that was our very first and second publication. We compared children with restless sleep with children that did not have any complaints of restless sleep. And then we compare it with children with something called restless leg syndrome.
Right. And I did want to ask you about that. So there is a restless leg syndrome does occur in children. And so the types of restless sleep that you are talking about with restless sleep disorder, is that, what differentiates that from pediatric restless leg syndrome?
Yeah, so restless leg syndrome usually occurs when the child is still awake or the adult, where at the bedtime or in times of rest, but it is still during wakefulness. And when the child goes to sleep, they may kick their legs during sleep, but they do not have the feelings of urge to move the legs that they have before sleep, so at bedtime. With restless sleep disorder, children do not have any disturbance before bedtime or any discomfort before bedtime, but they, once they fall asleep, is when they start moving a lot, and the movements are not necessarily leg kicks like in restless leg syndrome, but they are full body movements like repositionings, turning, like what we usually call tossing and turning, but while they are asleep.
Okay, all right, got it. And are there any criteria in terms of how frequently this might need to occur for it to fall into a restless sleep disorder? So is it like with insomnia, it needs to happen a certain number of times a week for a certain number of weeks for it to be considered chronic insomnia? Is it similar with this where a parent would need to observe this, like say most nights or just maybe four nights a week or what does that look like?
Yeah, so after our first research publications a couple of years ago, we got the attention of some international society of sleep, which is the International RLS Study Group, and they form a task force of 10 sleep experts. We had meetings over the year and we decided to come up with a diagnostic criteria, and with expert opinion, we recommended that the disorder has to be present for 3 months and last at least three nights a week. Most parents would say that this is something that happens every night.
Right.
We have in the diagnostic criteria that it has to happen. And one of the reasons that we decided is because there are other secondary causes of restless sleep that could be temporary, like weather, like noise, which we just had before from outside my house.
Right.
Noise, little situations, stress, and those usually improve with time. But if it lasts longer than 3 months, then we are considering restless sleep disorder.
Okay, got it. And this is a new disorder, although it is something that you have been researching for years. At this point, does it look like there's a genetic link involved, or are there some children who seem to be more susceptible to this disorder, and does it happen more often in a certain age group?
We studied From ages 6 to 18. And the reason we started at age 6 is because we wanted to be sure that the child was able to let us know if there was something bothering them. Like, we wanted to know if there was restless leg syndrome, if they had some urge to move, or if there was itching or something. So that was the only reason. We wanted to be sure that the child could communicate with us everything that would be bothering them, if any, at night. So we have only studied so far from ages 6 and up in children. We do not know if there is any genetic predisposition. So that's a direction for future research in this area. But we do know that, for what I know in experience, is that in the sleep center, we see it in about 7.7% of children that are referred. And it has been more often than none that I see siblings. Like, I see one child for restless sleep and another child for another sleep disorder. So I am curious if there is a genetic predisposition.
Right, right. And it may be just that once a parent begins looking for these things, then the parent is more attuned to what's going on. And so there's all sorts of other factors that may be contributing besides genetics, right? Yes. But it is really interesting.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about the nutritional link here that is interesting, that iron levels might play a role. Can you talk about that? And that is true also of pediatric or of restless legs syndrome as well, that there's nutritional links that are interesting. But iron supplementation, it can be really tricky because iron supplementation can cause issues, you know, constipation, and iron can also be really difficult to find sometimes, like in a multivitamin. So parents might not realize that their child isn't getting supplementary iron, even if they do take a multivitamin. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, iron is really interesting because there are a lot of substances in the brain that help process activities or situations in the brain. We call those substances neurotransmitters. They send signals, they participate in a lot of processes that occur in the brain. And those neurotransmitters require iron for their synthesis, for making them in the brain. So iron is what we would call a factor that aids in the production of this brain, important brain substances for movement, for development, for a lot of things in childhood and in adults. So particularly when we think of movement disorders, we're thinking of a substance called dopamine, and lack of iron has been shown to be participating in, like as you mentioned, restless leg syndrome and other movement disorders, that in adults we supplement not just with iron, but we can supplement with medications that include dopamine. In children, these medications are not approved, but iron supplementation is an easy way to really improve the transmission of the signals in the brain. Now, the downside is that we do not usually check iron in the brain, but we check it in the blood. And we are used to thinking of iron as just something needed to prevent anemia. But in these children and in children with restless legs, we have noticed that iron can be deficient in other body areas without getting to the level of having anemia. So more and more I notice that pediatricians are being aware of this factor. And for the sleep world, we recommend to check something called ferritin, which is a molecule that transports iron through the body, and also iron levels. But usually ferritin could be within a normal range, but the normal range is wide. So we wanted to recommend it to be a little bit on the middle range, most specifically above 50, a level of 50 for ferritin, while the normal could be starting at 10. But by the time that ferritin levels are 20 or 30, we have found out that there is already a little bit of deficiency in the brain. So 50 is the magic number for children. And ferritin levels below 50, we want to supplement with a little bit of iron. As you said, oral iron could have some side effects like constipation or bad taste or teeth staining. So I recommend, if there's a little bit of deficiency or to prevent deficiency, to maybe start with iron-rich cereals, like what you said, maybe ensure that there's a little bit of iron in the vitamins, but just iron in the diet in general. Green vegetables, spinach is a good one, like spinach pies or spinach in salads, or iron-rich cereals is a simple one. If we need to supplement, we start with oral iron. And if there are some side effects, we do have an intravenous iron program at Seattle Children's that has been quite successful.
Okay, thank you. So if a parent suspected that their child had this disorder, and it is a newly defined disorder, what would it look like in terms of getting a diagnosis first, and then what would the treatment look like?
Yes, so we do, so far for the diagnostic criteria, we do need a sleep study. So a referral for evaluation by a sleep physician would be the first step. We have a large lab at Seattle Children's with at least 10 sleep medicine providers right now. So we're always happy to see your child. And for the diagnosis, we do require a sleep study because there are other things that can mimic restless sleep syndrome. We can have, for example, children with obstructive apnea. And sometimes when the child sleeps alone in the room, the parent is not aware that they are snoring or that they are having restless sleep because of other reasons. So a sleep study would be required and a referral would be required. In the meantime, while you wait for the referral, it'll be important to really pay attention to other things. Is eczema controlled? Is asthma controlled? Are there any environmental things in the bedroom that can be disrupting sleep? Are there practices that could be disruptive, like noise or irregular bedtime routines, or maybe drinking a little bit of iced tea or something containing caffeine at night? So pay attention to those things prior to your appointment. Pay attention if the child snores or if there are any suspicion of other disorders. It will be really helpful in the diagnosis.
Right, thank you. And then in terms of treatment, what might that look like?
We will ask to have a blood draw, and it is not the regular, it is not the fingertip drop that usually are done for testing anemia. It is actually a blood draw from a vein, a couple of little tubes to check for iron levels. And if the iron levels are deficient, we will recommend supplementation, and we will talk to you about the benefits of both oral and intravenous iron at this time. There is the possibility that some children are not iron deficient and may qualify for both either the diagnosis of restless sleep or restless legs. And we do have a couple of other prescription medicines that can be used in this condition. So it is important that we discuss with the parents what are the options, the side effects, and things to look for in terms of side effects for medications.
Okay, great. But it sounds like iron is the first line.
Yes.
That you want to look at.
Yeah, and most commonly, I would say 90 to 95% of children, we do have a window to supplement iron. And we actually published our very first results on intravenous iron, and we found that about 80% of children do get better. And we have a range of getting better from 50% of improvement to a complete improvement. And we've had parents tell us, you've given us a complete new child, now sleep is restful, and the daytime symptoms have resolved.
I think that that's just so incredible with this and with restless leg syndrome, that there is such a strong nutritional link with results and outcomes that can just be so powerful by just shifting that one factor. I don't think enough people know about that, really.
It is amazing, and it is one of the most rewarding areas. I mean, a lot of things are very rewarding in sleep medicine for children because small interventions can make a big difference in a child's life. But this particular one with iron supplementation is really rewarding. And I think that it can potentially affect or improve other areas. As iron is a cofactor in other neurotransmitters in the brain, we may know that, you know, cognition and behavior and, school performance can also be improved. I am anticipating.
Yes, that is fantastic. And how quickly do these results show up? Is this something that improves gradually over a few months, or do parents usually notice a difference much sooner?
With oral iron, it's a matter of wait and be patient, because it is a slowly but surely way of replenishing the stores in the brain. With intravenous iron, maybe a little bit faster, but it is still a window of about 8 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and that goes by quicker than most people probably think. So can this disorder be managed proactively, sort of, so it never really gets to a crisis point in terms of just environmental? It sounds like maybe no, because it results from iron, and they need an intervention to make a difference. But are there ways that people can manage this so that it never gets to a crisis point in terms of just in bedroom environment and bedtime routine and things like that?
We don't know. I think that's a great question, and we would need to still study the natural course of this condition and how it started. Because as I mentioned, we have studied children at age 6, but how early does it start for parents to really pay attention and notice and start supplementation? We still do not know that. It having a healthy diet, healthy exercise, healthy sleep routine is always the first line of recommendation for prevention. So I would definitely recommend healthy activity, exercise, and a healthy diet. It's a way to prevent a lot of these conditions. But if the parents know that right now the diagnostic criteria requires about 5 movements per hour. So if we all shift and move at night, and we can change positions to one point over another. But somehow parents are really good at realizing that this seems to be quite excessive, to be moving a lot and changing positioning. So if that is something that you notice, get started with a little bit of iron and seek help from us. And we're here for you to help you.
Thank you. Is there anything else you wanted parents and caregivers to know about this disorder that we haven't talked about?
No, I think you've been really thorough. The one idea I wanted to emphasize of the secondary restless sleep, we're calling restless sleep disorder a primary disorder, meaning that it's a disorder on its own, but just the awareness that restless sleep per se can be secondary to other conditions, and it's important to be aware of these other conditions, either medical, pain, as I mentioned, eczema, scratching through the night, obstructive sleep apnea, or sometimes environmental, like uncomfortable sleep, temperature, uncomfortable bed sheets. So I've had parents modify some of their sleep environment to be more sensitive to the child's need in terms of temperature, comfort, even the light or the heavy of the blankets, and that has Right. been helpful as well.
Right. Temperature seems to be a big one too, Yeah. especially coming out of the hot summer months. Kids just don't seem to sleep well when they're too hot.
Exactly.
Where can people learn more about you and your work and get in touch with you if they want to learn more?
Yes, so I am at Seattle Children's and University of Washington, which both of them have websites, including a little bit of our work. I am in the process of recording a webinar for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine about pediatric sleep, restless sleep disorder. And little by little, we are being sure that more information appears on common websites, like we are trying to reach out to pediatric societies, pediatricians. So I think that hopefully it will be a broader area that parents can search and find the information.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing this with my listeners. I hope that it's helpful, and I think it really will be. I really want more people to know about this. It's very exciting. And congratulations to you on defining this new sleep disorder and taking this step.
And thank you, Malia, for inviting me again and for helping parents know about this new sleep disorder. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope this was helpful to you or to someone you love. You can find out more about Dr. Del Rosso and her work by looking her up. She's affiliated with the Division of Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine with University of Washington, as well as Seattle Children's Hospital. You can find me, Malia Jacobson, at maliajacobson.com. You can reach out at malia@sleepwellstable.com. And you can find out more information about the podcast, my guests, and links to full episodes at sleepwellstable.com. The podcast is also on all the social media channels, and I would really appreciate a rating and review if this information has been helpful to you, and also passing this on, sharing it with someone who might benefit from the information. I really hope that you're doing well, that you are transitioning into this new season, into fall, feeling a little more rested, maybe a little more ready for what's to come, whatever that may be. I hope that any of these episodes have helped you to sleep just a little bit better as we wind down our summer and look forward to what's ahead. I will be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, please sleep well and stay well. Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. Now you know. Thanks for checking out the show.